I've tried to justify all the excuses, and I've overcome them in my head enough times that, you know, I'm able to have that conversation with myself and say, like, this is a short-term crisis, basically, that you need to navigate, and you'll be so much more happier when you do.
We want to thank one of our longtime partners, Exoskin. You can find them at exoskin.us.
And the Exoskin Toe Socks has 5 new colors. Same great fabric, same great performance, all new colors.
Limited supply on this first edition run, but you can check them out if you do it right away. We also want to talk about their Rapid Dry Copper Technology. Why is this important to you, Don? It's because Rapid Dry Technology reduces body heat by decreasing the skin-to-fabric friction. And you don't want friction because that causes blisters and it causes chafage.
And you can get 15% off your first order by going to exoskin.us, typing in, what do they type in, Scott?
The code TRN, and they can get 15% off.
So go get yourself some new color and enjoy the performance of Exoskin Toe Socks.
Native cares about the products you put on your body. They're about stopping the stink the right way, the Native difference.
You probably already know about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant, but have you tried their body wash, toothpaste, or their new mineral-based sunscreen?
Yeah, we need sunscreen, Freeman. We're out there on the trails for a long time, and Native does it the right way with the right products and the right ingredients and scents. It's lightweight, it absorbs quickly, and you can choose between unscented or their charcoal and pineapple.
You can build your own personalized product bundles. Mix and match 3 of your favorite scents and keep them in rotation so you can have something for every occasion.
And they're offering 20% off your first order if you go to nativedeo.com/trail. That's nativedeo.com/trail. Hey, we have some exciting news. So exciting, we wanted to put it up front before the podcast today starts. And that is, we have some keys to our Trail Runner Nation bus that we're going to loan out, Don.
And 2 trusted drivers that it's going to take this bus on a journey, Anna Frost and Stephanie Howe.
And they have agreed. They've been on the podcast multiple times. If you haven't heard them, go back and listen to the podcast they've had. They are so good. And we are entrusting them for the first time ever. They're going to guest host an episode next week.
And clearly, Scott, they're much better than you and I. I mean, I would imagine some people will listen to their episode twice and probably bypass one of our new episodes.
Make sure you download that episode next week.
Ladies and gentlemen of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
just because the facts aren't accurate, don't worry about it. This is a podcast. This isn't. We don't even have a letterbox. Nobody's gonna write us. We don't even know where it is. I started to question myself. Maybe I'm a badminton player and not a runner. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman,
and I'm Scott War. And we've all heard the saying that endurance or ultra running is 90% mental and the rest is in your head. Is that what the saying is, Don?
That is the saying, Scott.
I can't remember. I keep forgetting because my mind is not what it used to be. It's true that endurance athletics does take a lot of mental training. And we've talked about that many times on the podcast. In fact, we talked with one of our favorite guests, Alex Hutchinson. And he was talking to us probably 3 or 4 months ago about a book that was going to be coming out by some people that he knew called The Genius of Athletes by research psychologist Noel Brick and best-selling fitness author and journalist Scott Douglas. And the book is out, and we are lucky to be joined by Scott and Noel on this. it's no surprise that world-class athletes get to their level or don't get to their level without some sort of mental, strong mental game. And it could be argued that you need that same mental game when you're running endurance, an endurance sport like trail running. When you're trying to get to 50 miles at finish line or a 50K finish line, and the furthest you've ever run is a marathon or a 10K, it takes a strong mental side to push beyond those personal limits. And we're going to talk to Scott and Noel about that today. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
The subtitle of the book, What World-Class Competitors Know That Can Change Your Life. And when I first picked up the book, I thought, the genius of athletes. Well, I definitely want to apply some genius to my athletic career, which is, you know, not really stellar, but hey, we're all competing against ourselves and the trails that we're on. And so I thought, yeah, I could use some of that. And as I started combing through the book and reading it, and actually downloaded it on Audible. So I got it into two different ways, my eyes and my ears. And I realized this book is more than just about genius for athletes. It's about genius in a way to approach problems, a systematic approach to accomplishing a process, performance, and outcomes. Those three goals are used to help us reach our objectives. So in life, it's more than just athletic goals. There's also personal goals. Was this book written just for athletes, or did you have something else in mind?
I think both, Don. I think, first of all, in terms of I suppose, what athletes might benefit from in this book, I think it might be too much of a leap to think that, you know, all the strategies and all the tools and all the techniques that we talk about in this book that, you know, every athlete might be familiar with them or every athlete uses these. I find in my experience and in my work working with athletes of different levels and different sports that I suppose a lot of the techniques that we cover in this book are A, learnable, teachable and learnable, and that I think a lot of athletes performance can benefit from learning some of these tools and techniques that we'll chat about over the next hour or whatever it is. But then I think secondly, a lot of these tools and techniques relate to our everyday life. So, you know, how we regulate our emotions, how we speak to ourselves, how we build our confidence. These aren't just things that can benefit us as runners. These are things that can benefit us in our working life, our study life, in so many different domains. So I think that's kind of the premise of the book, that A, there's these tools and techniques that the best athletes have learned and used to optimize their performance to achieve various outcomes, and that we can learn these and apply those to other areas of our life as well.
We often say that, you know, being out on the trail is a microcosm of life. What we can learn from our experience on the trail can translate over to the rest of our goals that we have, whether they're work-related or relationship-related, what have you. Do you find that there's truth into that fact when we make that comment? You know, life is just, the trail is a microcosm of life?
I would say that there's a lot you can learn on the trail that applies to everyday life. Life is full of ups and downs, just like a trail is. I suppose I would come at that from two angles. One would be just purely personal experience. I'm sure, like most of us, that there's so many things that we experience and encounter, be it, you know, emotions or thoughts in a long distance run that we have to deal with, we have to manage, we have to overcome, we have to have some sort of strategy in place to deal with those negative thoughts that might be telling us on a trail to give up, to stop, to quit, to, you know, what are you doing out here? And sometimes we experience challenges in life where we have very similar thoughts and very similar experiences. So one would be that. And then the other thing I would say as well is that from a research perspective and coming at it from my angle as I suppose a psychologist and a researcher, that what the evidence also suggests is that a lot of the tools and techniques that athletes use to benefit their performance, there's also evidence to show that they help people in other areas of their life as well. And so both are true, both the anecdotal experience and also the evidence base that we built this book on.
So I was lucky enough to spend some time with Ann Trason in the mid 1990s, and her then husband after I had dropped out of her 44-mile training run, I had a lot of time to spend with him, and he was saying how she's better than anybody he ever met at solving problems like while under duress. And to me, that seems like sort of a compressed example of what, you know, of sort of the basis of your question, that you know, when she's running Western States and gets a stomach problem, rather than giving up, she sort of analyzes the situation while continuing to make progress. And according to him, she was better at it than anybody. And, you know, obviously those skills are then easily transferable into everyday life. And we have a lot of examples in the book of people who were, or maybe still are, world-class athletes, and then sort of consciously applied these tools to succeeding in other aspects of their lives, whether it's starting a post-athletics career or dealing with an unexpected breast cancer diagnosis in the case of one Olympic champion. So I've long thought, and this is sort of one of my reasons for wanting to do this book, was the sort of like, you know, everything I ever learned about life, I learned through running, sort of thing. So I definitely agree with your statement about the trail being transferable to life.
And both of these guys know a lot about running, Scott. We didn't put that in the beginning, and we really should have, because since 1979, Scott, you've run over 100,000 miles, and Noel, you have over 30 marathons and ultra marathons underneath your belt. So as you mentioned the word learning from running, you guys have actually done exactly that. So go ahead, Scott. I just want to throw that in.
No, I'm interested on how a research psychologist from Ireland hooks up with a journalist from Maryland or Maine. Maine? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm in Maine. I grew up in Maryland.
Okay. Well, yeah. See, I read that. I could see it on your face that there was a Maryland connection there. How did this all come together? Both of you are endurance athletes. One's focused on the psychology of endurance, and one is a journalist. How did you guys meet, and how did this book evolve into the book that it is?
So my main work is for Runner's World, and one of my sort of beats in the work that I do for the Runner's World website is always sort of monitoring what's going on in sports science research, both on the physical side and on the psychological side. And so around 2016, I became aware of some of Noel's work. And at around that time, I was writing a book called Running Is My Therapy about running and mental health, and cited some of Noel's research in that book. And after that book, I was then trying to think, like, well, what do I want to write about next? And I've written a ton of books about sort of the physical training stuff at various levels. By now most people, you know, if they want to avail themselves of the information, most people know how to train physically. The psychological stuff, like, just sort of increasingly started appealing to me, just because, you know, just on a personal level of like, here's something I could still learn. And I sort of had the idea for the book, and I sort of realized that I would spend, you know, hours each day interviewing Noel Brick and then worrying that I was going to get it wrong. And so I proposed to Noel that we write the book together. And that was, what was that? Fall of 2018. And we actually, Noel and his wife spent a night here at my house the following fall, and we took it from there.
Noel, tell us about your experience as a research psychologist. What is that, and how did you get specialized in endurance?
Yeah, so I suppose it was a bit of a journey kind of to get there. So I've been lecturing sports science broadly since about 97. But in about 2010, 2011, I started my PhD. And originally it was on a completely different tack to what it actually ended up as. I spent about, I think, 16, 18 months going down a route, which ultimately, for various reasons, I couldn't progress on. I kind of reached the end of that particular trail. So in about 2012, 2013, I had this idea, you know, running for years has been my hobby, and I had this idea about doing some research on broadly what athletes think about. And it actually stemmed from my undergraduate degree studies way back in the mid-90s under a sports psychologist in the University of Limerick in Ireland called Dr. PJ Smith, who we dedicated the book to. And I sort of learned from him about some research at that time about various strategies that athletes used, broadly grouped under the terms of association, or focusing in on tuning in to how they feel, and distraction or dissociation. And that obviously stuck with me, you know, from that early time. So I had some ideas about that area of research and some things that I wanted to study. And when I reached the dead end on one PhD focus, I decided, you know what, let's maybe think a little bit more about these ideas that I had. So that started off as a big review of all the studies that existed on what athletes, runners specifically or mostly, but what athletes, endurance athletes think about and focus on, which we published in 2014. And that led, I think, then to what Scott sort of mentioned, or starting to talk about some of the studies that I published through my PhD. And when Scott reached out with that email in 2018 about this idea for a book, strangely, I was thinking about some very similar ideas at the time. And for me, being an academic nerd, I didn't feel I was very good at writing good stories that people would be interested to read. So I think it was kind of a good coming together of, you know, the academic background and then Scott's excellent ability to weave that with good stories.
So a great partnership formed, each bringing your own expertise and creating a great book. Let's talk about, in the book, you talk about goals. And I thought that was just very fascinating because we all want to accomplish something. We all have a next of some kind in front of us, whether it's a marathon or something different. Can we talk about goals and how you lay those out and how we can apply those so we can reach our end goals?
I would say first, you kind of mentioned some of the main types of goals that we have earlier on. You talked about outcome, performance, and process goals. And I suppose these are all different kind of goals that we set for ourselves. You know, an outcome goal might be to win a race or to finish in a top 10 or 50 or whatever it might be. A performance goal might be to, you know, run a marathon in a particular time, or to qualify for Boston, you have to achieve a particular time. Those kind of things would be performance goals. And then process goals are the tools, the techniques, the things that we do in a race to achieve a level of performance, which ultimately helps us to achieve an outcome. I suppose right from the get-go, there's a few things that are kind of interesting to know about the different types of goals that we focus on. And what the research would show is that when we focus kind of too much on outcome goals, so if we think too much about the end result of what we're trying to do, whether that's good for our motivation and can be helpful for motivation, when it comes to actually racing, when it comes to performing, those types of goals or focusing too much on that end result can actually be anxiety provoking. So what we talk a little bit about in the book is the benefits of focusing on process oriented goals, focusing on those tasks, those things. And that could be anything from, you know, what you say to yourself, how do you plan to deal with difficult moments, right the way down to maybe, you know, your running form, those kind of things, the things that help you achieve a level of performance. And when we focus on those things, and especially those things that we have control over, that ultimately tends to lead to better performance, but B, we tend to feel more in control, we tend to feel less anxious, and we tend to feel, well, I guess ultimately perform better as a result of those things as well. So I guess that, you know, the goal mix, that's one of the first things that we speak about, and the importance of having different types of goals, yes, but also the importance of focusing on goals that we can control and those process goals that ultimately lead to the outcomes that we try to achieve.
In your book, you've interviewed a number of elite athletes, or you've gleaned information from them. When you had established the process of the goals, of the process goal, the performance goal, and the outcome goal, did you already have that framework in mind and validate it by speaking to these different individuals? Or did you go out and say, after talking to all these people and doing the research that we've done, it looks like, have you filtered things out, and then all of a sudden drops out process, performance, and outcome? Did you go in with the hypothesis, or did you find it after you've interviewed?
Well, I think one thing I would say is those kind of ideas about goals and the different types of goals and the advantages and disadvantages is there's actually quite a large body of research there to support these. So this goes right back to work in the 80s, 90s, etc. So I guess that's coming at that from the research angle. But in terms of speaking to athletes, when I kind of, you know, in some of my research from some of the elite, you know, Olympic, world championship level athletes that I've spoken to, you very much find the same narrative, you know, that when these athletes are focusing on performing at their best, these are the things that they think about. These are the things they focus on. And what I've absolutely loved, you know, in some of my research, I sometimes kind of say my research is my hobby, my work is my hobby, but sometimes just kind of listening to these athletes and we tell some of these stories and bring some of this research into the book, how intricate the detail they go into is about what they think about and what they focus on in specific moments. And I suppose when we talk about focusing on the process, that's one of the key things is, you know, you said at the outset that running is 99% mental, and it's, you know, the mental tools and techniques that we have to deal with those challenging moments that can be so important to focus on in those times.
Yeah, I would add that there was nothing in anybody who we talked with for this book or who I've talked with for other parts of my work that sort of contradicted what, you know, the published research on this finds. And I think it's one of these cases of the athletes have hit upon what works, and then the researchers are describing what works to a certain extent. So an example from my non-book writing life is for Runner's World, one of the people whose writing I edit is Molly Huddle, who's two-time Olympian, has a U.S. record at 10,000 meters in the half marathon. And she wrote an article for us on Runner's World once about, you know, what does Molly Huddle think about when she races? And it was one of the most read articles of that year. And soon after it was published, I shared it with some friends who I run with. And then I was on a long run with two of them a few days later. And, you know, so we start talking about Molly Huddle's article. What does she think about when she races? And one of my friends is, she's very physically talented and, you know, sort of held back primarily by mental barriers. And she was just fascinated, like, oh, I never thought about that. I never thought about that. The other friend I was running with was a one time, at one point in the 1990s, won the national marathon title. And she was basically like, well, of course, that's what Molly Huddle thinks about when she races. Like, to her, it was all just like, well, yeah, of course, that's what you do. Whereas to me and to my similarly unsuccessful non-national title winning friend, we were both like, wow, that was so insightful. So, yeah, it's a case of sort of these interviews and stories from the athletes all sort of you hear the same points over and over again. They've all sort of worked it out with some counseling, but also just sort of on their own.
So Scott, that is really interesting to me. I'm curious, of the two people that you're talking about, the two people that went on this long run with you, how did the marathon champion know? Is this something that she had a coach to teach her this? Is this something that just came innately to her personality? And why don't we all have that?
Right. So, I mean, one of the main premises of the book is that you can learn all this stuff. And she was coached during her best years by Benji Durden, who was on he made the 1980 U.S. Olympic marathon team. That was the team that didn't go to the Olympics, but he like talked to her pre-race about all these if-then scenarios, which we'll get in, you know, we can discuss later. But now where Benji Durden knew it from, I don't know, but Benji Durden sort of imparted this knowledge to my friend Julia, who then she coached. She was like an assistant coach in college and passed it along to the people she coached. Not all of us have direct access to Olympians and national champions. So hopefully our book can give you some of those insights. But in her case, I would say primarily that she was taught a lot of these things. You know, they would the day before, I mean, the night before, like a big marathon, they would go over all these scenarios. You know, if you don't get your bottle at halfway, what are you going to do? You know, if you, you know, fall off pace at 16 miles, what are you going to do? If this happens, then I'm going to do that. And so he taught her a lot of these techniques, this if-then thing being one of the main things that she's talked about and what he taught her.
Scott, I want to get into that if-then stuff because it's a great part of the book. But I've got to ask Dr. Noel Brick here, what should I be thinking about on these runs? You mentioned there are things that need to go through our head. As a psychologist, what kind of things should be running through our minds?
One related to the goals, one athlete that I interviewed, an Olympic marathoner, and this quote's in the book, and it stuck with me from when I heard her speaking about it during her interview. So this was a study I published a few years ago, and so she was an Olympic marathoner, and I kind of had this image of this person who would sail through a marathon event like it was so easy for her. And one of her quotes was that she said, if you were to stand on the start line of a marathon and think, I've got 26.2 miles to run here, you'd go crazy. You just wouldn't start. And this was an Olympian. I thought, wow, so what do you focus on? What do you actually think about? And she said, so she chunks, she breaks down the goal into little smaller sub goals. So she may be focused on getting to just the first 5 miles. And I think on trail runs, we're maybe accustomed to doing that because we have, you know, maybe stops along the way for water stops, whatever it might be. But she would do that in a race. She would just break it down. So that was one of the strategies that she would use. Just chunk it down. Get to 5 miles. Don't worry about the next 21. Just get to 5 miles. When I get to five, I'll maybe focus on getting to eight. And when you're at eight, you know, it was this kind of Irish accent. She spoke really quickly. But, you know, when I got to eight, sure, you're nearly at 10. You know, and when you're at 10, you're nearly halfway. So you just kind of break it down that way. And then suddenly you realize you've half the race done and you've only got 13 left to think about. So just chunking it down, just kind of breaking it down, setting these little micro goals. And I guess then you can build on, layer on your other goals. You know, so when you get to five, you can check your time, see if you're on course for your performance goal or your position in the race, your outcome goal. So but that focusing on the process is certainly one thing. Look, I mean, there's so many others, and we cover a lot of them in the book, but the if-then planning strategy, I think, is one of the key strategies about, you know, it's something we don't often think about. Scott mentioned about, you know, what are you going to do if, and all those various obstacles, all those worst case scenarios almost that might play out. And sometimes we prefer not to think about those things because, you know, if we think about them, suddenly maybe they become reality or whatever. But actually, from a psychological perspective, thinking about it, but having a plan in terms of how you will deal with it, how you will respond rather than react in that situation, is so helpful to your performance. And so I think that simple, you know, if this happens, then I will do that, or then I will think, or then I will say this to myself, is so useful to help maintain our performance in spite of maybe some of the obstacles we might encounter.
You know, I was just thinking, and I think you answered my question, Dr. Brick. You know, it's kind of a tightrope that we're walking. If we're sitting down the week before, the night before, and we're thinking of all of the things that could happen, all of the negative things that could happen, and we're coming up with solutions, if this is going to happen, then this. You know, in my mind, I kind of think this is a tightrope. Maybe I'm thinking too much on the negative and not on the positive, and I'm filling my heads with all these negative things, and maybe even predestining some of those things to happen during my performance. From the research, Noel, I'd like to get your opinion. And then from your experience, Scott, talking to these elite athletes, your opinion on that. Is it bad to think about all of the negative things? Does that take you down a negative road instead of just thinking positive, positive, positive? Noel?
For me, there's two or three different things that are important to say there. One is, you know, you're absolutely right. So what the research would say is that when we develop these plans and we have a response in place for a potential if, okay, don't overthink the if then. Don't focus on the if. You know, if it happens, you've got a plan. You've got a way of responding to it. Now don't worry about it, you know, because if it happens, you know what you're going to do. So you're absolutely right not to overthink it, not to have it in the front of your mind, maybe going into the race. The other thing I would say as well is that it's not always about negatives. You know, what if you find yourself at the front of the pack halfway through the race? That, well, that's a positive, but that can throw you. That can completely derail you because you didn't maybe expect to be there, or you're ahead of a target time. Do you ease back? Do you keep going? Again, all those potential positives are maybe things to kind of think about as well and have a plan in place. But you're right. Once you've got it, then park it and know that you, sorry, feel confident that you know you're going to do, or you know what you're going to do should that situation arise.
Yeah, and to build on that, I would not mention the word confidence. And one of the things in the chapter on self-confidence is past mastery. So having successfully navigated a similar challenging situation in the past, when I've talked with elite athletes, they don't say past mastery, but that, you know, that's sort of the research term for it. That's something that comes up again and again. It's like, oh, I've been in this situation. This is like in training when such and such happened. And it doesn't have to be an exactly analogous situation, but you'll hear people after a race talk about, oh, such and such happened, and I thought about, you know, this similar event and how I got through it. So it's not like, because it's not like every race has a whole new set of unprecedented potential bad things that can happen. Like they could have happened in all the other ones, right? And they've thought about them to some extent and they've mastered them to some extent. And then, so therefore, I don't think they're like sitting around the night before just running through a list of 112 things that can go wrong tomorrow. I think it's a lot more subtle than that, and this idea of like having gotten through this difficult thing before, I think provides a lot of confidence that even if I encounter a novel difficult situation, I've navigated something difficult before, and I can get through this one too without having to obsess about it the night before the race.
No, I really like how you brought up a if then for positive. I always was thinking like Scott, negative. Think of this, you know, if this goes wrong, if my shoe blows out, if, you know, all of a sudden I cramp, I'm going to have these solutions plugged in. Because one of the things that happens to us out there is our brains quit working. Why is that, Noel? I don't know. But at a certain mile marker, you know, all IQ is reduced by a multiple of some. And so we need things, if thens, in place, because we're rationally thinking when we're creating our thens. And so we're ready, and we can calculate, and then we can plug that into the equation. So when chaos is happening and catastrophe and IQ is dropped by two-thirds, then we can just plug it in. And I think that's real important. And I never thought about having the good on the if I'm ahead, if I feel fantastic and I feel like running faster, if that happens, then I don't, you know, just something in place. Scott Warr?
I was just going to say, Scott Douglas mentioned he's interviewed Ann Trason a number of times, and that one of her superpowers is the ability to solve problems. Is that because she's gone through this process of if then, or is she fly by the seat of her pants and something happens and she's very able and quick and has the ability to say, this has gone wrong, here are three things that I can do to overcome that? Is it the if then process that is part of her superpower?
I'm not sure. Back when I spent time with her, I wasn't as up on all the phraseology as I am now. But she they were talking about and so when was I there? 1996. So I think that they were talking about like the Western states in 94 or 95, and it was super hot, and she was not keeping food down and stuff. And I forget the details, but it had something to do with chewing on ice. That was the solution to her problem. And perhaps it had to do with, that was a way to stay hydrated without, without regurgitating everything. And her then husband, you know, said, you know, at 85 miles, you know, I can't even think of like which foot is my left foot, right? And she's thinking through, you know, well, okay, if I chew ice here, then such and such will happen. So I don't know the specifics, but I would say that part of it is just a sort of general background of having encountered several many difficult situations and pretty much always getting through them and you know, being able to not panic. And Noel can talk about the importance of sort of emotional regulation. And I think that that, you know, goes hand in hand with this idea of if-then planning, because if something goes wrong and you just freak out, even if you have a great plan, it sort of doesn't matter. But if you have a good practice of being able to regulate your emotions and staying calm, even when things seem to be going haywire, then that could probably help in that situation.
One thing as well, just, and I think you've hit on something great about decision making. What the research is showing with if-then planning is that when we have a good plan in place or a plan in place, that our responses become not automatic, but more automatic. So in other words, in the moment, we don't have to think through, we don't have to think rationally about what is the best thing to do in this situation. We've already done that thinking. So the thinking has been done. I just engaged the plan. And so our response becomes more automatic. The need to think through the reaction or the response is less. And like you said, Don, you know, when you're maybe 85K or longer into a race and your ability to think rationally is reduced at that point because you're fatigued, then having good plans in place really helps to do the right thing in those situations.
On the podcast in the past, we've referred to those as simple rules. When I just have my simple rules together, if I start to feel like a cramp coming on, the simple rule is whether I want to or not, no matter who I'm chasing, I'm going to slow down. I'm going to back off. I'm going to start drinking a bit more. I'll take care of electrolytes if I need it. I'm just going to reassess what's going on, and I won't ignore that and push through it, because I know from practical experience, small cramps become big cramps, and you can push on and experience the big cramp, and then your performance suffers even more. So recognizing things early, staying in tune with what's going on, and making your if-thens on small pieces of clues, small data, instead of catastrophe. That's what makes, I think, the Ann Traysons and the real veterans and masters of having early warning radar going on through their whole body, and something pops up. They make corrections without even showing suffering of their performance. They can stay running in a way that doesn't look like a catastrophe occurred because they avoided it. They just backed off, you know, 7% or whatever it might be.
Hey Don, real quick, a little side note context. We've mentioned Ann's name a few times. For those people who are new to this podcast or new to trail running, who is Ann Traysen, and why are we putting her on this pedestal?
You know, if you go to Ultra Sign Up and you look at any of the results of runners, and you see their performance score that's on there, the number of races that they've won, if you travel across the name Ann Traysen, you'll see that she dominated in ways that no one has ever dominated ultra running, in my opinion. I think the number one runner of all time has to be Ann. And she has 14 Cougars, which is what you're presented at the end at Western State. She has 14 of them at home, which nobody has come close. And so she has raced all over the world and has established a well-known name through the decades of from her performance and just being super tough and super an elite athlete in not only just her physical component, but her mental component. And I think that's why she came up, just because she looked early like she was already ran 100 miles when she pulled into the third aid station, but she just kept putting it together and staying out in front of the group. So that's who Ann Traysen is.
Yeah, the reason why I thought it was important to bring that up is 14 years, she was the number one female at Western States 100. That's 14 years peak performance. She has Leadville wins where she almost was the overall winner. I mean, has dominated for years, which means she's probably got some of this formula that you have in the book, the sauce, the secret sauce that you guys talk about in the book. She may have figured this all out intuitively, where Noel has looked at it from the research standpoint, and Scott, you bring in the stories to back it up. I think that that's important to know.
Yeah, we just stole her recipe, actually.
We're going to change our pace for just 60 seconds to talk to you about the BOA Fit System and the new La Sportiva Cyclone shoe.
We know that La Sportiva makes some of the best trail running shoes, and they're even better with the BOA Fit lacing systems.
They allow you to perform at your peak with increased connectivity, precision, and control with their micro-adjustable dial, their super strong lightweight laces, and the low-friction guides. And you can win one of 10 free pair that we're giving away. Go to boafit.com/TRN. You got to do it this week because on July 16th, they're going to draw those 10 lucky winners to get their free pair.
And now back to the show.
Hey, I want to get into this emotional component that Scott mentioned. Noel, what does the research tell there? Because there's times in my life I can have a little bit of a temper, and I need to know how to control those emotions. What does the research show? What can I do to make me a better person?
Well, I guess I suppose we cover a lot of different strategies, and there are a lot of different options available to you. The sort of background here, I suppose, to some of the strategies and tools for emotion regulation that we speak about in the book is that there are various points where we can regulate an emotion, either before the emotion happens or after the emotion happens. And so some of the strategies that we talk about are, if you like, almost things that you do before you get to the point where you might experience anger or anxiety or whatever the emotion might be. And then we've got some strategies in there which, if you do experience that emotion, these are things you can do to, you know, to maybe decrease it if it's a negative emotion or emotion you maybe don't want at that time. So one of the first ones that we speak about is a strategy called reappraisal or reframing, which is basically taking a situation that you might be in, and it could be a situation that you can't necessarily do anything about, but maybe looking at that situation in a different way or considering it from a different angle. I really liked the example, Don, that you gave earlier where you spoke about having a cramp. That scenario could sort of play out. So that situation could kind of play out based on what you tell yourself. So you experience a cramp and then you start thinking, oh, that's my race finish. Here we go. It's going to be another cramping hobble to the finish line, get there, you know, 2 hours slower than I wanted to. So that's one set of thoughts that you could have. But an alternative set of thoughts is taking that exact same situation and thinking, okay, well, this isn't the end of the world. If I slow down here, if I manage myself for the next hour or whatever it might be, then it's not going to necessarily go that way. So it's a different way of thinking about the same situation. And ultimately, the emotion that you experience as a result of thinking differently is very different. One could be real frustration at experiencing the cramp, and another could be, like you described, Don, actually quite rational, calm response to exactly the same encounter. So that's one of the first strategies, and I think a really helpful strategy to think about is how we can view the same situation and the story we tell ourselves about that situation in a slightly different way.
In the book, you talk about there are 28 ways that runners commonly put themselves pre-race to help with this emotional regulation. Is that ringing any bells to you? did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, so it was one study that was done by it was led by Professor Andy Lane, who's based in Wolverhampton in England, and they basically surveyed runners before race and asked them about the various strategies that they use pre-race, and there was a lot of things that we might expect, you know, runners keeping themselves calm, maybe by taking deep breaths, maybe sort of pumping themselves up by, again, whatever, you know, they might say to themselves to do that. What's actually really interesting, and Scott, you mentioned about anger. What was really interesting about some of the work that Professor Andy Lane has done is that some runners would actually upregulate what we might think as unhelpful or negative emotions. So they might deliberately make themselves feel a little bit angry because their perception, their view was to perform at their best. Those were things that they needed to do. So I think what's interesting is we normally think about people trying to lower negative emotions like anger, anxiety, and increase positive emotions like maybe feeling calm or feeling excited. But actually, depending on our perception, we can regulate different emotions in different ways if we feel they'll help us perform at our best. So we talk a little bit about that. I mean, there's lots of different things. Another study has shown that there's over 160 different techniques we can use to regulate our emotions. So I guess there's lots of different options, but some are more helpful than others. And I think that's maybe something we'll chat about as well. For example, expressing emotions versus trying to hide them and suppress them.
As you're talking, and I don't know why this came into my memory, is I'm thinking of John McEnroe, you know, top tennis player in the world, extremely bad temper. And I wonder if he used that to help him perform better. He was regulating his emotions to, like you said, sometimes you can use that anger to benefit or maybe psychologically defeat your opponent on the other side of the net in his case, maybe.
Coincidentally, I actually watched a documentary about John McEnroe about 3 nights ago, and he was asked this exact same question, and his perception was now, as a 60-plus-year-old looking back in his career, was that sometimes it was instrumental. So in other words, sometimes, yes, he maybe did do those things on purpose to try to put his opponent off, but actually he said most times it wasn't, and he kind of wished that he maybe had some of the different ways of dealing with the emotions that he experienced on the court. So, you know, this book could have been written a long time ago and benefit John McEnroe maybe, but but it was quite interesting actually, because he sort of, you know, looked back at some of those times and said, you know, if I didn't react in that way in that game, I could have won that major championship, you know, and that was one of his reflections on one of his tantrums, if you want to use that phrase. Really interesting about John McEnroe.
I was going to say, can you be too positive with the reframing? You know, I know people, and I may have been accused of this in the past, where something negative happens and you completely, maybe you don't even recognize it. Maybe you just turn everything and reframe everything into a positive. Is that a bad thing?
I would say it depends on the context, and you know, it depends on what's most helpful at that time. In terms of reframing, I think, you know, some of the times we might reframe very often things that we might perceive. If I just give one context, for example, when it might be helpful and then when it might be less helpful. If we're talking about something that we're maybe focusing on in a race that might not necessarily be in our control. So if we find ourselves thinking about the weather or a competitor and what they're doing, and focusing too much on those things, that typically maybe leads to less helpful emotions. So feeling anxious, feeling worried, feeling frustrated, you know, whatever it might be. So a simple reframe in a situation like that might be, well, okay, the weather's not what I want or whatever, but it's the same for everybody else. You know, if I just focus on running at my fastest, dealing with these conditions, doing whatever I have to do in terms of my nutrition, those simple thoughts can help. It's not just about being positive, but it's about increasing your perception of control in that situation and thinking about things that are more helpful to your performance. So that would be one thing I think that I would say, that it's not just about being positive, but it's actually maybe what you might focus on that's more helpful to your performance in that context.
Yeah, I would add that. Long before Noel and I started working on this book, one thing I heard again and again from elite runners is this idea of like focusing on what they can control and trying their best to set aside concern about things they can't control. Champion marathoner Meb Keflezighi told me about riding the bus out to the start of the New York City Marathon one year where the weather was just horrific. And just, you know, as evidence that not that some people are better at this stuff than others. He's on the bus with all the, you know, lots of the other elite marathoners in the race. And he said half of them are freaking out. They're like, look how windy it is. Look how cold it is. And he's sort of like, well, I can't do anything about the wind, you know. why spend any mental energy on that? Uh-huh. He instead focused on like, okay, well, it's going to be windy. How best then? Should I run this race on this day in these conditions to place my best? So this idea of like what you can control and what you can't control is a very simple idea, but it's something that I've heard for decades now from top elite runners is you know the crucial importance of being able to make that distinction and then follow through on that.
That's great.
You bring up control, which kind of segues into a part of the book where you talk about habits and triggers. And I think that's something we can, we'll talk about that. And it's something we can all benefit from and take away from the book and become better at what we're after. So can we talk about habits and triggers?
Yeah, I guess I suppose just one thing to explain about what exactly habit is and why they can be either helpful or unhelpful. So earlier on when we were talking about if-then planning, I'd say that, you know, having a plan in place makes your response more automatic, but not completely automatic. Habits are slightly different. Habits are automatic responses to triggers in our environment. So for example, if you run every morning, when you get up, without even really thinking about it, you're putting on your kit, you're putting on your running gear, you're getting ready to go for your run. You don't wake up and consciously think about that and consciously decide, what am I going to do this morning? So that's what we mean by it's an automatic response to a trigger. Where habits become really, if we talk just about in terms of being helpful, is exactly for that reason. When we don't have to think about things, when we perform helpful behaviors like going running or whatever it might be, without having to consciously think about it, then those automatic behaviors are I guess helpful. Where they're less helpful is when we've got habits that we don't necessarily want to do, but they're still automatic responses to a trigger. And our thinking can be just like that. So again, an automatic response to a cramp, for example, might be catastrophizing. And that is could be a habitual response in that situation. So that's where a habit, like a thought or like an action, can be less helpful. So I'm sure we'll maybe talk about, you know, how we can change habits, et cetera. But just to explain a little bit about what habits are and how they can be either helpful or unhelpful sometimes.
One of the things that I took away from reading through that was I could identify a habit that I wasn't happy with, that wasn't pushing towards an end goal that I was after, and then trying to find the trigger. What happens to me before I do that bad habit? What are the things that place me into that spot where I perform the bad habit? So I just start rewinding a bit. Is it because I like the example that you said where you sit on the couch, watch some TV, and when you do that, you get a snack. And that's kind of what you do. And so maybe changing part of that trigger. And you brought up the example of I drink a glass of water, I eat a piece of fruit, and I go walk around the block, and then I come back. And then I find myself in a different frame of mind. I'm not after that same thing because I changed the trigger so that wouldn't happen. So I really thought, as I look at all the things that I wish that I wouldn't do at the end of the day, what are the triggers that set that up that just made it happen automatic? I need to get in front of the trigger to avoid the habit. And you could draw a story around just about any habit with that.
Just one key thing that you just threw in there, which is so important as well, is that very often these things, you know, happen at the end of the day. And when we're tired, when we're fatigued, when our ability to self-control is a little bit less. Because when we try to override habits, it requires a lot of self-control, a lot of willpower, and that depletes through the day. So typically we find that we indulge in those snacks and things like that at the end of the day when we're tired and our willpower is lower. And you're right. So that's where maybe changing the trigger, so recognizing what is the trigger in our environment and you know, doing something to either change that trigger or change the response to the trigger if we can't, you know, change the situation itself. But I think the other key thing is that it takes time and it can take time to build a habit. And the key thing to do is to repeat whatever the behavior you want is to repeat that in response to the trigger. So to have the water, the piece of fruit in that environment, but to repeat that until a point where it becomes more automatic and that you don't have to think about it. But that takes time and that takes a little bit of repeated action to become a habit.
Well, Dr. Noel, you brought that up and it really brought light to my reality is Don is a better person in the beginning of the day than he is at the end of the day. I wake up with great promise, right? And at the end of the day, I'm a wreck. And maybe that's why we run first thing in the morning. Maybe it's like, okay, you know, pushing it off, the later I push it off, the chances become lower that I'm going to be excited about doing it. And so I think that's interesting. With good rest, that we're better off in the beginning of our day, and really speaks to how important rest really is for our life. You know, a completely different topic and one worth, I would even listen to not only an episode on it, I would listen to a podcast called Sleep because I think it's just that important.
Chapter 11. This is a really cool chapter, Scott, and I want to have you guys weigh in on this. Stop the stopping. How to keep going when the desire to quit feels overwhelming.
all of us have been there, whether it's a training run, whether it's a new distance, whether it's an FKT attempt. How do we stop the stopping, Scott?
Keep going.
Well, there you go.
Suck it up, Buttercup.
Yeah. I mean, if I could answer from a personal level, I would, for me, it's what's always most helpful is reminding myself of the personally meaningful reason that I'm in this situation in the first place. I can only speak for myself in this case, but for me, that's the most helpful thing is like, why am I doing this? I'm choosing to do this. And if I stop now, then I'm not going to meet this personally meaningful goal that nobody forced upon me, that I have worked for a long time. So on a personal level, that would be my answer. I'm curious to hear what Noel says.
Scott, so you say that you need to kind of reframe it and make sure that you have a purpose or a why to keep you going through those hard times. You've run over 100,000 miles.
Yeah.
What is your why? What is your purpose? Is it the same or does it change?
I mean, in a general sense, I never think about not being a runner, if that's what you're asking. My life is immeasurably better in every possible way because of being a runner. And I would never consciously, I can't see that I would ever consciously stop doing that. On any given run, of course, that's a different matter. Every day is sort of part of my overall life project of being a dedicated runner. And to maybe tie it back to this idea of habit stuff, like, I mean, I don't have a streak. I missed 12 days earlier this year because I rolled my ankle on a trail. But I mean, otherwise, when I'm not hurt, I run every day. And from this idea that Noel was talking about, of like, it's just a habit. I don't spend any mental energy thinking, am I going to run today? Am I not going to run today? Is when am I going to run today and where am I going to run today and how fast am I going to run today? Whereas one of the friends I was talking about earlier, she really struggles with consistency. And it's because every day she says, oh, am I going to run today? You know, and she thinks that my sort of daily habit requires a lot of mental energy. And I'm always trying to tell her, like, no, it takes no mental energy. I know I'm going to run tomorrow. You know, it's just a matter of when and where. So anyway, in terms of me personally, I don't have much problem seeing things through. I mean, by now also, I mean, I've been running for 42 years. Like, I've tried to justify all the excuses and I've overcome them in my head enough times that, you know, I'm able to have that conversation with myself and say, like, this is a short-term crisis, basically, that you need to navigate, and you'll be so much more happier when you do.
I bring this question up for the round table. How do we best handle that? Eventually, there is limitation to matter. We can only go so long before something breaks down, whether it's a hip or a knee that takes us out for a period of time or just reduces our joy, reduces our performance to a point that we're embarrassed to look at our own watch and when no one else is around. How do we manage this decline in performance, in age, in body mechanics? How do we address that as a person and give ourselves permission to let father or mother time have her way with all of us? How do we wrap our heads around that?
I'll let you know when I figure it out.
Okay. Well, that's closer than I am.
Well, no. So, independently of this, I've been listening to some lectures on stoicism. And there's this interesting idea in stoicism of what is it called? Negative visualization, where you imagine that some part of your life is taken away from you. And I have found that incredibly helpful. I mean, so yesterday I did 400 meter repeats, and yeah, I'm 57. And I, you know, am now running 400 meter repeats. My 5K race pace is what my sort of normal daily pace was 30 years ago. And yeah, there's one way in which it's really difficult to run as hard as I did 30 years ago and run more than 20 seconds slower for that 400 meter repeat. It's better than not doing it though. it would be the stoic answer. You know, I just, again, on a personal level, I'm fortunate to have long ago recognized the incredibly important place of running in my life. And I'd rather be doing it than not doing it. There's a whole separate thing of like, what are the physical things you can do, right, to slow the rate of slowing and to keep your body more like it used to be. But from a psychological standpoint, it sounds simplistic, but to me, I just think about, well, what's the alternative?
Reframing.
Yeah. Well, right. What's the alternative to not run, to not challenge myself? Be like everybody else. Doesn't seem like an acceptable choice.
Noel, you had something to say.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of angles that I would come at to answer this. One is, you know, spending some time and thinking about if it's just running or if it's more broadly exercise is what you asked about. What is your why, Scott? And you know, really sort of digging into that, you know, why do I do this activity? Why do I run? What do I love about running? What do I enjoy about it? And I'm going to keep that underpinning there for a second, and I'll come back to it. But I'll sort of layer it with a bit of a personal story. A couple of years ago, in between training for two marathons, I sort of became aware that my reasons for running and what I was doing and thinking about in a run were changing. So I would go out on what should have been an easy run, and I was checking my watts, and I was, you know, getting cross with myself or giving off to myself if I wasn't running even an easy run at a particular time or at a particular pace. And what I kind of noticed from reflecting on that was my reasons for running were changing. I wasn't going out for a run to enjoy it, just to experience it. I was going out, and I was being controlled by my watch, and my motivation was changing because of my watch. So I spent between those two marathons, I spent 6 months without wearing my watch once, because I just wanted to reconnect with, Scott spoke about values, I wanted to reconnect with why running was important for me. I wanted to just go out and enjoy a run and not care about how fast I was running, just to observe the nature around me, to feel good while I was moving. And those are things I love and really enjoy about running. So coming back to values, you know, it's kind of good to reflect sometimes on why we run and why we're doing this, and really digging into, you know, 3, 4, 5 reasons why we're doing that. Because in terms of our motivation, those things are really important. And I think if I was to reflect, you know, I'm getting slower now, I'm not able to do the reps as quickly as I used to. And if that was my main driver and motivation for running, I would finish every run feeling deflated and not enjoying what I'm doing. But that's not why I run. And so I think that's kind of an important part of that process as well, to kind of think about the deeper motives about why we run, and maybe being okay. I wouldn't quite say reframing, but maybe actually accepting that, okay, you know, I'm getting older, I'm getting a little bit slower, but hey, that's okay, because I can still get out, I can still enjoy my run and still take part in something that I absolutely love to do.
I also think that, like, running, one of the great things about running is that there's so many ways to be a runner that, you know, if you're open to exploring different ways as life goes on, there's probably a lot of different ways that you maybe haven't spent as much time on. I run trails a lot more than I used to, because I used, you know, 30 years ago, I was a split checking road guy and, oh, the trails are just going to get slow. You know, and now in Maine, I can run on trails half the year. And that's where I spend all my time, and I don't care what my pace is. And there's just so many ways to be a runner, and so many interesting people to meet. And one nice thing about getting slower is that I get to meet more people to run with. You know, I mean, 30 years ago, like I ran with fellow fast guys in their late 20s. I was the only people to run with. And now, you know, now I can run with so many more people and benefit from those relationships, which is one of my main reasons for running.
Yeah, I think those are both very, very good answers. And I think that they'll apply to all runners out there, because at some point, you know, we'll all decline just a bit in performance. But what we hope doesn't decline is our passion. And as long as there's some passion there, then you can plug in a rationale or a reason or a new why to get out there and do it. And not get discouraged just because the times aren't there, that you lose your passion. Was your passion being out there and experience nature and navigate the course and stay upright? Or was your passion moving fast? Well, then I would suggest you roll down your window and put your head out, because there's some speed for you if that's what you're into, you know, but there's a lot going out on there just to enjoy nature itself. So I like both of your answers.
And I will tell you, Scott, from my experience, the better stories are from the guys that are slower runners, because usually they have a lot of experience and they have some really good stories. That's the reason why I run in the back of the pack. Not because I'm slow, Don. It's because I enjoy the stories from those people.
They have more time to make up the story. That's all.
Hey, Noel, I have a final question for you. As a research psychologist studying endurance events, what has been one of the most surprising studies that either you've done or you've read about lately?
Well, there's so many, but one that immediately comes to mind that I know Scott is a big fan of as well is, so there's a chapter in there where we talk about self-talk, the things that we say to ourselves, and that can be simple statements like, you know, when a run's getting tough, like, I can do this. This is tough, but I can keep going, push through it, those kind of things. But this study, what they did was they took those exact same statements and they had people repeat them either in the first person, so I can do this, I can push through this, or in the third person. So they spoke to themselves, but it was, you can do this, you can push through this. And what they found, it was a lab-based study, and they had the participants. It was a 10K cycling study, and they had to complete it as quickly as possible. And what they found was that when people were speaking to themselves in both the first and the third person, it felt equally as hard. So it didn't feel easier when they were doing either two conditions, but they cycled faster when they were speaking to themselves in the third person, the you in comparison with the I person. I think it was something like about 2.2% performance difference at the end of the trial. I absolutely love that study. I think it's a really interesting study about how this subtle shift in terms of how we speak to ourselves can be just as important as what we actually say to ourselves. So that's one that comes to mind for me straight away, Scott.
So it's just the pronoun. Instead of saying, I can do this, talking to yourself, you can do this. That is fascinating.
It really is. And so we talk a little bit about that in the book. And there's a larger body of research on this outside of the sporting context. So where researchers have looked at, for example, people doing presentations. And again, you know, in preparation for that, if they're feeling nervous speaking to themselves, either in the first person or the third person. And across the board, what these studies tend to show is that people tend to perform better when they speak to themselves in the third person. And actually, even in the presentation example, people were objectively rated by viewers as performing better, again, when they had spoke to themselves in the third person versus the first person. So you're right, a subtle shift in pronoun seems to offer big advantages in terms of performance, both outside sporting context, but in terms of sport as well.
Hmm, interesting.
Well, Scott and Don, what do you two do? I mean, now that you think about it, right? So you're halfway through a tough trail run and you need to talk to yourself. Do you say I or you?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to have to go back. I mean, so I do remember some research that was saying that it does help to say it audibly instead of thinking it, to actually verbalize it, that there's some performance improvement there. I don't audibly say anything, any self-talk like that. But I don't know. I'm gonna have to go out for a hard run and figure that out.
I just use the if then rule. if the starting line is closer and my car's there, I'll go back. If it's closer to the end, then I continue on. That's really my if-then rule. One final question. Scott, you had your final question. I've got one that we have asked literally for 10 years that we've been doing this, Scott. And now we finally have the right audience to get the definitive answer.
Ah.
We're all at the starting line.
Pressure's on, guys. Pressure's on, guys.
And you have the gift of gifting us all 10% more performance ability or 10% more mental character ability, however you want to phrase that. Do you want us to be 10% tougher physically or 10% tougher mentally? Which way would you guys lean?
I would say the mental, and not just because it's the book that we wrote, because there are tons of examples from running history where people who are much more physically talented lose to people who are less physically talented. And so physical talent isn't the be all and end all. And I would also give the same answer from the standpoint of even with a 10% physical performance boost, most of us are still not going to be anywhere near the front of the pack. And we're running for our own personal reasons. And that the being better equipped psychologically is much more likely to more often lead to satisfying outcomes or satisfying experiences that than simply having the same crappy mental experience but happening to finish 2 minutes faster, right? So I would definitely go with the psychological.
No, before you answer, so we've cloned the person. You know, we have two Scott Wars standing there. We gift one with 10% physical power, 10% mental. I think I would put my money on the mental too. I'm going to figure that physically fit Scott is going to make that same dumb mistake and have that same chatter in his head that's going to take that physically fit guy out. So, Noel, what's your philosophy?
Yeah, I would say if we could do that, then...
Real quick, the flaw in that, Don, is 10% more mental capability isn't going to get me anywhere because my mental capability is so low. Go ahead, Noel.
Have you seen your physical lately? Go ahead, Noel.
I would absolutely say the mental because, one, you can apply the mental to other areas of your life. It's, you know, you might be a faster runner if we took them at the physical, but with the mental, you can apply it to the other areas of life. And secondly, I would say, you know, by increasing the mental, you also increase the physical as well. So it's win-win.
Good. Well, that really wraps up the book nicely or the podcast, because it's more than just about becoming a better athlete. It's about becoming a better person in life and becoming better physically or mentally prepared to handle all of life challenges that come at you. And so you teach us lessons through the book on not only to become better physically fit athletes, but also better performers in life. And so I think that end statement from you, Noel, was the perfect wrap. So thank you guys both for coming on and enduring both Scott and I for this this episode. And we've learned a lot from it.
The book is The Genius of Athletes. And you don't have to be a genius to be an athlete in this case. It's teaching you how to become a genius. The Genius of Athletes, What World-Class Competitors Know That Can Change Your Life. Great book. It's available anywhere you buy books. Don says it's even available in an audio form.
Yeah, I downloaded it from Audible. Very good. Well read and well produced. I enjoyed it.
We hope you get this. We hope that it improves your capabilities out there on the trail. And more importantly, that you run
Moss.
We want to give special thanks to our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley, with Ameriprise.
Think of Doug as your pacer or crew for your finances, because he will take care of you.
You can find him at Doug Crumley Jr., DougCrumleyJr.com. It's the end of the show, and we would be amiss if we didn't thank a few people. First of all, the listener. Thank you for making it to the end of the podcast. We knew it was probably harder than running 50 miles, but we're grateful to you. We're grateful to our Patreon supporters. We need to talk about the Cocopelli 1000, which is coming up. Those Patreon supporters have bibs. They're waiting to learn more about that. If you want to become a Patreon supporter, go to trailrunnernation.com and click on the support us at the top of the screen.
We need to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, who helps put this thing together and gives us some direction. And importantly, sound man Ryan, who really makes sure that, well, we sound like we're doing our job, Scott. Without him, it would be chaotic.
Tune in next week for another episode. Thank you.